Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. We begin our program with some daily selections from Science of Mind Guide for Spiritual Living. Verify and clarify. My therapist told me the way to achieve true inner peace is to finish what I start. So far today, I have finished 2 bags of chips and a chocolate cake. I feel better already. Dave Barry. When the inner thought is clarified, when it knows the truth, it will reinstate the outer in peace, poise, health, and happiness. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 475. If things are open to interpretation, there are as many ways to understand a moment as there are people to undertake the understanding. This is why clarification is essential. The understanding of your reality through your subjective mind makes you an infinitely unique expression. The world is a compilation of influences from media outlets, amplified to play on your sentiments in order to persuade you to perceive events and people in certain ways, while encouraging you to believe you think these things. Independent thinkers, those who broaden their perspectives with exposure to various viewpoints, are scary to those determined to direct the narrative. Whether it is a bully who wants to get to you through fear, or a clever and artful storyteller who moves you emotionally, remember to verify and clarify. When information overloads us, we can easily forget that not everything we read, hear, and see is true. These 3 questions can help you determine whether what you're seeing, hearing, or reading is true. What is the source? What is the evidence? Most importantly, do you want to believe it's true? Your responsibility is to ascertain what is true and to get clear on what's important to you and what's not. Affirmation. I understand more deeply than just what the words say. The gentleness of a four-legged friend. The best therapist has fur and 4 legs. Anonymous. The intelligence in an animal, which directs its actions and tells it where to go to find food and shelter, we call instinct. It is really omniscience in the animal. Ernest Holmes, The Science of Mind, page 342. Our 4-legged friends offer us a giant channel of gentleness. Their unsurpassed ability to teach simultaneously takes us on an enchanted journey of the heart. They teach us to play, to love unconditionally, to live in the moment, and to communicate without words. They demonstrate to us the qualities of loyalty and dedication. They even show us how to forgive. Animals have a way of making us feel special, of getting us to laugh, and even of shifting our moods. They bring us joy, calm our nerves, and soothe our souls. As members of the family, our pets think they are our children. They bring us love, offering it at our feet as if it's the morning paper. This caring creates a special bond beyond what words can describe. Our furry friends understand us with all their hearts and souls. This kind of unwavering love is sometimes hard to find in our human relationships. Coming home to a wagging tail or a purring vibration can help dissolve the stresses of a day, sometimes more effectively than a deep conversation. Anatole France wrote, "Until one has loved an animal, a part of one's soul remains unawakened." The reciprocal loyalty between humans and our animal companions is a divine exchange. It is spirit made manifest. Affirmation. Every moment I feel the love I shared with my pets. And from the Daily Word published by Unity, appreciation. I appreciate the good in my life. When someone admires my efforts or thanks me for something helpful I've done, I'm happy to know I have blessed them. Recognizing how good it feels to be appreciated, I remember to express my gratitude and appreciation to the people who have blessed me. I appreciate my friends and family by nurturing those relationships. I appreciate my community by being a responsible citizen. I appreciate the natural beauty of the world by caring for it and taking time to enjoy it. The people, the places, and the things I appreciate become more precious to me as I discover that each reflects God's presence and God's spirits, the universe's activity in a uniquely beautiful way. I am grateful to have so much to appreciate. And in honor of Earth Day, Earth Blessing, I bless the earth with love and gratitude. What a brilliant miracle this earth is. In a delicate, intricate balance, this beautiful, majestic planet sustains itself and all the life on it. I show my reverence by lovingly caring for my earth home. I take care to reduce my use of materials and resources, recycle what I can, and put items back into circulation instead of throwing them away. I bless my earth home with prayers of health and peace. I pray others around the world feel the same and join me in holding the health of our planet in prayer. I'm grateful for this miraculous, marvelous planet I'm blessed to call home. With love and gratitude, I commit to doing all I can to live gently upon the earth. And from Mark Nepo's The Book of Awakening, Having the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, The Gift of Surprise. Another name for God is surprise. Brother David Steindrast. While rushing to complete your dearest plans that you tell no one, you can bump into another, and groceries will fly, and while picking up the ketchup, you might fall in love. Or in your second year of college, while studying what mommy and daddy want you to be, you can accidentally open a book on Albert Schweitzer and discover that you feel compelled to go to Africa. Or, understanding geometry, you might decide to become a gardener, finding endless joy in creating landscapes. Or, the death of your grandmother might open a side of you that is starving for history. In my case, losing a rib to cancer made me discover the Adam in me. It seems that any moment of interest or pain or adversity can surprise us into the larger totality of life, breaking our current limits and allowing us a chance to redefine ourselves in regard to the larger sense that is upon us. That we are opened so suddenly, so often, is the way the soul unfolds on earth. We can never be prepared for everything. No one person can anticipate all of life. In fact, over-preparation is yet another way to wall ourselves in from life. Rather, we can only prepare for how we might respond to the gift of surprise that often moves in on us faster than our reflex to resist. Life is surprising, thank God, and God, the chance to know oneness, lives in surprise. For God, Spirit, the universe, is seldom in our plans, but always in the unexpected. Center yourself and pray for the strength of spirit to be open to surprise. As you exhale, try to relax your resistance to the unexpected. As you inhale, try to make a passageway for everything larger than you. Enter your day. We return now to Science of Mind for Steph Swink's monthly column, Ask Steph. Trust the creative power of God. I'm an 80-year-old woman with no immediate family. I've always enjoyed life, and whenever I have a problem, I work on ways to correct it. I've been using Science of Mind magazine since 1999 and largely believe in the philosophy. The last 6 years have brought numerous physical problems, all with considerable pain. What have I done to attract this? I'm in good health and could enjoy quite a few more years. How do I overcome the fear things will get worse before I die, that I'll become dependent on others? The first letter I wrote as a ghostwriter for Louise Hay, selected for publication, was about the word problem and one of its definitions, to throw forward. It also means a question proposed or, in logic, a preposition that appears neither absolutely true nor false, and consequently may be asserted either in the affirmative or negative. I share this because you have the proven ability to throw forward a challenge and correct it. Now look at the additional meaning of the word. Regarding what you have done to attract these painful experiences, consider that way of thinking is neither absolutely true nor false. Perception is everything. Your body has carried you through 8 decades and is experiencing some difficulties. This does not mean your consciousness is in error. Fear is understandable and malleable. You have the power to throw forward your concerns about the future to the creative power of God, of spirit, of the universe, thereby opening to new ideas, options, and plans around needs and resources. What is important to you now and for the years ahead? Autonomy? Connection? Peace? I have clients in their 80s, and I love witnessing how they cultivate acceptance, gratitude, and presence, even with physical challenges. Enough cannot be said for cultivating gratitude. As Osho said, whenever one is full of gratitude, there is a temple. Your body, mind is a sacred temple, always. Decide to be dependent on the higher power that lives in and around you, and trust that grace will continue to bless and guide you. Namaste. Steph Swink, RSCP, has been a practitioner since 1999. As protege and assistant to Louise Hay, she was a frequent ghostwriter for the Dear Louise column. Through speaking, spiritual counseling, and workshops, she inspires others to create fulfilling lives they love. Connect with her online at Steph Swink, STEFSWINK.com, /ask-steph-submission. And from the same issue, by Michelle Medrano, Giant Gentleness, Being a Safe Place. Consider this important question. Do you feel like you're a safe person? The answer might be yes, if the definition of safe means intending not to harm others. However, most people only consider certain aspects of themselves when answering this question. For example, if you are not someone who becomes enraged and hits people or ever yells or screams, you might be tempted to declare yourself a safe person. Writer Anne Lamott quipped, "My mind is a bad neighborhood that I try not to go into alone." Because science of mind teaches us how consciousness works and how thoughts at a person's deeper levels can broadcast deeper intentions, we may need to consider an expansion of what it means to be a safe person. For example, a person might be nice, full of sweet talk and kind comments, yet when with a trusted confidant, that person may speak cruelly about others. Or a person might be doing their best to work with another person, all the while thinking negative thoughts about them or their work. A person might be quiet and never make a wave, yet perhaps they seethe inside about what idiots surround them. Eventually, these thoughts leak out in some form or another. Behaving as if no one knows your real thoughts is a huge illusion. Not everyone can read minds and assess the actual thoughts of others. However, the thought atmosphere is always present, like an energy that broadcasts itself. When a person has negative thoughts, their energy broadcasts a kind of spiritual bad breath, repelling others. Though such thoughts might not be spoken or shared out loud, other people often can sense them. This can erode trust, prevent real connection, and affect self-esteem. Therefore, doing our inner work to become a safe person, a peaceful person, and a safe haven is vital for genuine connection and greater peace on our planet. The sacred role of a practitioner. Ernest Holmes was a genius in many ways. One of his greatest gifts was creating the sacred role of a practitioner. A practitioner is someone who practices this teaching on behalf of themselves and others, such that they plumb the depths of their own divine nature and ideally clear away as much of their unhealed past as possible. Holmes knew that if beings accomplished this work, they could be examples, way showers, providing a safe space for those who choose to work with them. A practitioner can offer giant gentleness. They pass on their accomplishments by working with others to help them heal their own unhealed pasts. This is vital work. If we consider that all the ways in which humans harm other humans arise out of pain, of feeling and belief in separation, and some sense of disconnectedness, we can see that not being willing to heal and resolve our pain makes us potentially unsafe people. Every grumpy, bumpy, nasty, mean, or violent thought, word, or act is born out of unresolved pain. If we resolve our pain, our natural-born states of peace and well-being become the genesis of our thoughts and actions. To have peace and be a safe person requires that we do our inner work to heal the unhealed past. Working with a practitioner, coach, therapist, or counselor is valuable because most people just cannot do this healing on their own. If they could, they already would have. Spread a voice of positive energy. When there is a resolution of pain from the past, not only do we feel good, we also set in motion an energy in every interaction. More compassion is present in our interactions. People can enter and leave the thought atmosphere of a resolved person with their dignity intact, feeling good. This energy spreads like a wave across the landscape of human hearts. We can easily imagine the wave of it is negative or challenging. Person A struggles with a personal issue and is unwilling to get help to resolve it. They trot off to work and run into a coworker, and because of the space they're in, they're rude or thoughtless to the coworker, Person B. Person B is hurt because Person A treated them badly, just like my mother treated me for years. Person B, in turn, badly treats the next person they run into, and so on, the wave grows. This scenario also works if Person A starts out treating Person B positively. Additionally, if any one of these persons refuses to accept the way they're treated personally, and if they care for the grumpy one, the wave changes. Healing demands powerful inner work. Each being is a cell in the body of the divine. The question really comes down to whether you are a healthy cell or a cancerous cell. It is vital to take responsibility for making choices that allow you to embrace giant gentleness. You must be rigorously honest with yourself about the challenges, issues, and unhealed energy still active within you. You must be willing to see how it plays out in your relationships with all beings. You must face your judgments and biases. You must do the powerful inner work to heal all of it, because it matters. It matters to you and to every other being you share your life with. There are those who feel that all unhealed issues can be removed with prayer. There are those who feel that all unhealed issues can be removed with therapy. Healing may actually require a both-and approach. If unhealed issues are like weeds in a garden, the work required is to pull those weeds from the garden of your life prayerfully and through other counseling support. Yet some weeds root deeply. They may require more energy to remove. Just like when weeding an actual garden, you may find weeds with thick stems and deep roots. These do not come out with the first yank. It may take a few tries before you're able to pull that weed. Removing, healing, and going beyond unhealed issues in consciousness can require that we pay attention to the intensity of a given issue. Some issues are like small weeds, easily pulled with minimal effort. Other issues are more like big, thick weeds, demanding maximum effort to pull. This effort may require more profound professional help. It is important to understand the variety of issues that might show up, and you must be willing to do the work. That work will have a number of elements, including being willing to see the issue more clearly. That work might look like a willingness to feel your feelings and emotions. It likely will look like forgiveness and letting go. It perhaps resembles loving ourselves through it. It definitely will look like being gentle while doing your healing work. All of this work is part of ushering in the kingdom of heaven and actualizing peace on earth. Make giant gentleness, as evidenced by being a safe person for others, a high priority. This will be the greatest and most rewarding work of your life. And from the same issue, we turn to Questions and Answers by Reverend Dr. Jesse Jennings. Notice repetitive situations. Is everything actually the precise effect of some identifiable cause, or some occurrences just accidents or coincidences? Answer. Ernest Holmes wrote, "Since there is such an intimate relationship between our subconscious thinking and everything we do in life, and these deeper subconscious or subjective motivations, as we call them, work automatically, doesn't it seem reasonable that what we have done we ought to be able to change? If some subconscious operation of our thinking accounts for most of our diseases and a large percentage of our accidents, and I would add most of our unhappiness, I would go a step further and say that it is the same medium that is silently attracting or repelling what ought to be good from ideas of power. Let me clarify this. Everything that happens is the effect of some cause, and identifying cause can be anything from a fun pastime to a neurotic trudge, depending on how and when we approach it. In the case of accidents, what matters most is what we do afterward to clean things up, as well as simply deciding to pay more attention to the tasks at hand. A sound metaphysical approach is to notice repetitive situations. Everybody now and then drops things, breaks them, or stumbles over them. We wear physical bodies in a cluttered space with which our interactions won't always be graceful and adroit. We know what to do about this, and we do it. But if a similar mishap takes place again and again, it's pointing us to the subconscious, where we find our own embedded beliefs, plus messages about maintaining our overall wellness. Einstein famously observed, "Coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous." Because we all exist in one universal mind into which we think and feel, and from which we draw inspiration and creative ideas, we're all connected, not only to that, but to one another. Our searches for knowledge and experience are searching for us, too, and we become each other's beneficiary through apparent chance meetings and, literally, extraordinary insights. What do you believe about yourself? Question. Is praying to amass great wealth a legitimate part of a spiritual practice? And if so, does it work? Answer. I can't say firsthand if it works, having been gifted from the start with wise teachers pointing me toward managing causes rather than effects. Money is an effect. It has no consciousness of its own. We can go buy things with it, naturally, unless we happen to be stranded on a desert island, in which case it's useless for anything but starting a fire. So then we'd need to pray for some matches. The people I know about who enjoy vast wealth, and whose choices I respect, don't seem to have actually prayed for wealth, but instead prayed to realize their creative visions and make a difference in the world. All our desires spring from and report back to our beliefs about ourselves, which are comprised of ideas and the emotional energy in which we've encased them. Working at this level means asking ourselves why we want what we want, the good we believe it will do, and what new choices will appear after attaining our wants. Lavish prosperity often appears to serve as a shortcut to a lot of feeling states we can't imagine having otherwise. These may include feeling admired, respected, empowered, and generally free. A great question to ask ourselves is, what stands between us and feeling these ways right now? We do this because a sudden influx of money or any other material effect isn't going to bestow self-worth upon us. Again, for this, we must look to causes. Holmes said it best, reprinted in the August 1998 issue of this magazine. We are not struggling toward wealth, then, as such. It would not make us happy. Happiness is an interior quality, a state of being, the result of knowing that in the long run, the divine will win, the knowledge that we can trust the integrity of the universe. Our good will come to us in such measure as we ourselves measure it out in our own experience. We turn now to the March-April issue of Unity Magazine and an article by Louisa Rogers, The Architecture of Holiness, Sacred Journeys. Visiting a Sarajevo mosque during the holy month of Ramadan proved to be more spiritually intimate than this visitor ever expected. As I stood in the Sarajevo bus station around 6 p.m., I looked around and wondered where I would spend the night. I'd heard that most hotels here in the capital city of Bosnia were either destroyed or wildly overpriced. Suddenly, I overheard a man speaking Spanish and walked over to him. He turned out to be a journalist from Madrid, and I asked him about nearby hotels económicos. Sergio led me to a former barracks 5 minutes away, a building remodeled into a hotel by wounded refugees who had received a grant from the European Union. Later, he reminded me it was Ramadan, the holy month when Muslims fast during the day. We walked around the old city, watching the worshippers pouring out of the mosques and eating for the first time since dawn. It was January 1998, 2 years after the Dayton Accords, an agreement which had brought a fragile peace to the former Yugoslavia after a 3-year civil war that destroyed the country and whose tremors are still felt today. 4 days after arriving, I was introduced to a couple who offered room and board. Zora and Branko, a seamstress and a retired post office worker, lived in an apartment in a 3-story building whose broken ground floor windows were a common sight in Sarajevo. Inside, though, I felt completely at home in my cozy room, crowded with heavy furniture. Neither Zora nor Branko spoke English, but between photos, sign language, and dogged persistence, we communicated with tenderness and humor. Why Bosnia, of all places? Looking back, my reason for going to Bosnia seems a bit strange. I'd been in a downward spiral, uncertain about my business in California, unclear what to do. 2 close friends, both fellow training consultants, were stratospherically successful. I felt so threatened by their success that for months I hadn't been able to focus on what I needed to do to grow my own business. I knew I needed to do something to get out of my funk, and through several surprising synchronicities, I ended up in Bosnia. While there, I talked to several nonprofits about post-war challenges and gave a team-building workshop to one of them. In return, I was invited to the first conference for nonprofits between the divided parts of Bosnia. But a highlight of being in Sarajevo during Ramadan was something I hadn't even envisioned doing. On several occasions, I attended services in mosques, which provided surprising spiritual insights still meaningful today. The sensory service at a mosque. On my second day in Sarajevo, I noticed streams of people entering a mosque and decided to join them. But when I approached the entrance, a man pointed at my pants and shook his head. "No," he growled. "Why not?" I asked, my direct Western style seeming to catch him off guard. "I am imam," he stormed, referring to the Muslim equivalent of a priest. Disappointed, I found a market that afternoon and bought a long knit skirt. The next day, back at the mosque, I lined up my shoes in the courtyard outside with all the others and entered the building, wearing the skirt and a scarf around my head. As I started to follow the other women halfway up the stairs to a low balcony, one turned and frowned. She adjusted the top of my scarf so that my bangs were concealed. As I took my place in the women's section, I noticed the ceiling, so low. I had assumed the ceiling of most mosques would be high and vaulted like a church. Instead, I found myself in a square space that didn't look much higher than my living room. Rather than formally arranged pews, worshippers were kneeling on beautiful overlapping Persian rugs in ancient colors of blue, rose, ochre, and magenta. The lights were soft. The women huddled together on their knees, whispering, their legs tucked to one side, some wearing thick padded sock-like slippers to keep warm. Below us, men stepped soundlessly across the rugs in their socked feet and knelt. Some wore head coverings, resembling yarmulkes, looking indistinguishable to my untutored eyes from Orthodox Jews. Others looked contemporary, wearing leather jackets and jeans. I heard a click, and the wail of the imam's taped call began to pour out of the speakers. I found his voice to be a piercing, melancholy sound that penetrated deep into my chest and being. Soon I lost myself in the hypnotic Arabic chanting as I peered down at the rows and rows of male feet below me, bare feet and socked large feet and small, gnarled and well-shaped, cracked and smooth, noses pressed into the rose-red rugs, backs humbled, souls staring out at me. I'd never seen anything so tender in my life. God and fear. As I sat silently, absorbed by the chanting and the soft colors around me, memories of churches I had attended in childhood tumbled around my mind. My family moved frequently, so there were a lot of images. Once when I was 10, as we were driving to the Presbyterian church we attended in suburban Washington, D.C., I asked my mother what the phrase, fear of God, meant. I'd seen the words on a church pamphlet and was confused by the association of God with fear. Just then, my baby brother started crying. Mother got distracted, and I forgot to ask her again. Somehow, I was left with the impression that fear and God logically and naturally belong together. But why? I wondered as I looked at the rows of feet below me. The imam was now reading aloud in old Arabic, people following along silently. I had no idea what he was saying, and didn't want to know, because if I understood, I might start going down cognitive paths and arguing in my mind. The less I knew, the better. I'd be indignant, too, that women were consigned to a small section upstairs. But since I wasn't one of the faithful, I could overlook the aspects of Islam that I wouldn't otherwise be able to accept. And meanwhile, I felt safe with the other women in the intimate, cloistered section. I was one of the sisters, and delighted by all the sensory pleasure and depth of feeling around and within me. The geometry of spirituality. The chanting stopped, and for a moment the room was silent. I went back to thinking about the various churches I had attended growing up. They were all angular buildings, their interiors painted white. I could more easily see how God and fear might be connected in those formal structures. Yet here in this mosque, for the first time in my spiritual history, I didn't feel any such sense of vastness or formality. In fact, I felt quite the opposite, cozy, intimate, and friendly. Could spirituality be cozy? Such a strange, unfamiliar concept. Suddenly, I wondered how much my spirituality had been shaped just by the physical environments where my family worshipped. And what was it about sitting on the floor rather than being elevated in a pew that made me feel connected with these strangers? Did sitting on the floor equalize and humble us in some way that a chair did not? I wasn't sure. I just knew that I was having a different experience on the floor than on a pew. We began bowing. Out of the corner of my eye, I watched a girl about 12 next to me. She turned to me, smiled, and I followed her. We began on our knees, then we stood, knelt, foreheads and noses pressed into the rug, then sat, knelt again, heads turned to the right, now to the left, palms caressing the face, and I thought with a stab of pain of the snipers and the stained blood you could still see on some sidewalks near the mosque. How could a building that housed such beauty become the object of destruction? The prayers ended, and people started to leave. The women were in no hurry. They sat and talked in low voices. I nodded my goodbyes to them and stepped outside, where I put my shoes on and headed back to the apartment. Reflecting on my experiences in mosques, my visit to Sarajevo took place 25 years ago. Until then, I'd never been in a place where spirituality was in the air in such a palpable way, not just within the mosques, and not just cordoned off to a special time and place. Hearing the imam's call 5 times a day, watching the crowds flooding out of the mosques after the last prayers at night, crowding the cafes to drink coffee and eat desserts after the day's fast, seeing mourners visiting graveyards. Spirituality as it was practiced back in America seemed very private and hidden by comparison. Remembering gazing at the feet of the men below me, I ponder what humans search for in houses of worship. I believe we long to connect with the ineffable. What I learned through my exposure to a religion that was not mine and never will be is that, for me, the way to connect with the spiritual is through the physical. In childhood, I was left with the impression that spirituality was otherworldly and distant. But what I discovered in Bosnia, which has never left me, was that it wasn't far away at all. It was right under my knees. The soft, colorful fibers of the rug as my nose pressed against it. The aspirated sounds around me as people chanted. The warm feeling of my socked feet beneath me. God was not remote and somewhere else. These simple things were themselves holiness embodied. We pause for a moment to remind you that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications. And you are currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. We continue now with the book we started last week, Co-Creating at Its Best, A Conversation Between Master Teachers, Dr. Wayne W. Dyer and Esther Hicks, The Teachings of Abraham. Note to readers, this book is based on the Hay House live event that took place on November 13, 2013 in Anaheim, California, and the transcript of that event has been edited slightly in these pages in order to enhance readability. Since there aren't always physical English words to perfectly express the non-physical thoughts that Esther receives, she sometimes forms new combinations of words and uses standard words in new ways. For example, capitalizing them when normally they wouldn't be, in order to express new ways of looking at old ways of looking at life. For ease of reading, the questions and comments from Dr. Wayne W. Dyer will be boldface, while the comments from Abraham will be regular typeface. Reed's Idea. Reed Tracy. Hello, and welcome to this wonderful event. My name is Reed Tracy, and I'm the president and CEO of Hay House. We are streaming this event over the internet, so you may be a part of the show during the audience shots. There are thousands of people all over the world who will be watching along with you. I've been at Hay House for 25 years, and this is one of the most exciting programs that I've been waiting to see myself. I called Esther up one day, and I said, I have this crazy idea. What do you think of Wayne Dyer talking to Abraham, just the two of you, on the stage together? And she said, I think it's a great idea. And I said, oh, good, now I'll ask Wayne. This is going to be a super exciting evening, and so without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Wayne Dyer and Esther Hicks to the stage. Esther. Thank you very much. Hey, you guys are ready, Esther to Reed. What have you gotten us into? Wayne. Oh my goodness, I'm so happy to be here and talk to a ghost. I've been waiting for this for years. Audience member. I love you, Wayne. Wayne. Oh my goodness, I love you too. I love all of you. It's so nice to be here. Esther. Well, somebody asked me what we would be talking about tonight, and I said, I don't know, and I don't want to know. I didn't want to get anything in my head, but I really do like the idea of someone brilliant like Dr. Dyer talking to Abraham. What could be better than that? It really is co-creating at its best, isn't it? Wayne, it really is. In 1987 or 1988, someone sent me a big collection of Abraham cassette tapes, and I started listening to them. And then Jerry and Esther and I made contact maybe a dozen years or so ago, and I've been just an incredible fan of Abraham. I think it's the wisest and most profound teachings on the planet today. I do. Esther, Wayne has sold more of our books than we have. Wayne, I'm a true believer. You know, when someone is telling you the truth, and when you really feel the truth that's in your heart, you know you're being told exactly the way things are. Esther, yes, resonance. Wayne, yeah, it just resonates with me. It always has. And you've never missed in the hundreds, perhaps thousands of times I've heard you. Esther, I'm going to go get Abraham. Is that all right with you? Wayne, do you need GPS or anything like that? Or Esther, it just takes a minute for me to clear my mind and they'll say, hello, okay? Esther playfully to Wayne, who are you going to go get? I have a feeling you're going to go get Abraham too. If you really want to know, I think that's what you've been doing for a while too. Wayne, well, you know, there are many times when I do exactly feel that way as well. Yeah. Esther, okay, here I go. Who is Abraham? I'd first like you to just tell me and everyone watching and everyone here in this room who you are. Who is Abraham? For those who don't know, including me, would you tell us? The most important thing to explain is we are a collective consciousness, a vibration, not different from that which all of you have access to. But because of Esther's focus over the years, she has managed to accomplish a frequency, so to speak, that allows her to hone in on us so she can hear us in a more pointed way. Everyone who is physically focused, and that includes all of you, is an extension of source energy, and we are that source energy that you are all extensions of. But as you move around through your day-to-day experiences, not meaning to, you often find vibrational frequencies because of what you are observing that prevent you from receiving the fullness of who you are. And we are the fullness of that, you see. Some have tried to get us to define ourselves in physical terms, but we cannot. And we are not whispering words to Esther that she is repeating. We are offering blocks of thought, and Esther is finding physical words that match those blocks of thought. Everyone is capable of doing this. You all can receive this inspiration. However, you can be inspired from different points of attraction. You could be in a very bad mood and receive inspiration, but then you are not receiving inspiration from source energy, but instead from blocks of thought that have been left along the physical trail, so to speak. And so it's a matter of tuning to a high frequency and doing it often enough that there is consistency to what you are receiving. That's the easiest way of explaining it. And the most important thing that we want to say to you and to everyone is you are all doing some of that, but you don't usually do it consistently. And Esther is not always in the mode of receiving Abraham either. But in a forum like this, it is easy for her to receive us because of the expectation of the audience. We write in on the momentum of the desire that all of you have already established, and then Esther translates our vibrations, our knowing, into words. So you are really a collection of vibrations of this higher and higher frequency, equivalent to God, would you say? Humans have a hard time defining us, and they also have a hard time defining God, and they also have a hard time defining those who once were in physical bodies who have now reemerged back into non-physical. As humans, we love you so much. You have a screwy perspective of this continuum of life. Most humans believe that you come into these bodies and you live for a little while and you get it right or you don't, and then you leave, when really what is happening is you are eternal. You never really leave. And even when you are no longer focused in your physical bodies, you are still consciousness, and you are still focused on what's going on here on Earth. There is a collective consciousness that is so interested, so eager about everything that you all are about, and that source energy is what man wants to call God. You all have direct access to that. So, I've often said that we're not here as human beings having a spiritual experience, but rather it's the reverse. We are infinite spiritual beings just having a temporary human experience. When you stand in your now moment and you have practiced yourself into a high-flying vibration where you're not ornery or you're not upset or you're not worried about anything, you then allow inspiration to flow. Now you are so much more than what you have thought yourself to be. Now you are the extension of source energy. That's when you feel clarity and passion. That's when your timing is good. That's when you're at your funniest. That's when you feel the best. You create your own reality, and you do so because the thoughts that you are thinking cause you to emanate a vibrational frequency that the law of attraction is constantly responding to. And so in all waking moments, you are creating your own point of attraction, and everything that you experience is coming to you because of your vibrational emanation and the response of law of attraction to that vibration. It is as if you are standing on a sort of spinning vibrational disc, and only things of the same vibration can join you on your disc. Your disc changes depending upon the thoughts that you are thinking and the emotions that you are feeling. You choose the disc by the things that you focus on. You could choose one that feels like elation, or love, or freedom, or joy, or you could choose one that feels like grief or despair. You can tell what disc you are on by those who meet up with you. If you are surrounded by ornery people, you are on the ornery disc. It really is that simple. They have rendezvoused with you because you are perfect vibrational partners. As you are able to place yourself consciously on these vibrational spinning discs, you can then understand unequivocally why every single thing that happens to you or to anyone else is happening. What is inspiration? I wrote a book years ago called Inspiration, using the two words inspire, in spirito, inspire, in spirit. And there was a great teacher on this planet a couple thousand years ago named Patanjali, and he said, when you are inspired by some great purpose, some extraordinary project, all of your thoughts break their bonds. Your mind transcends limitations, your consciousness expands in every direction, and you find yourself in a new, great, wonderful world. And then he said, and this is what I want to ask you about, when you are inspired, dormant forces, faculties, and talents come alive, and you discover yourself to be a greater person, by far, than you've ever dreamt yourself to be. It's almost as if you discover yourself to be God, or Source, or the Tao, or Divine Mind, or whatever name we place on this Source energy that you speak of, and speak to us from. And this is Abraham responding to Wayne Dyer. The way that we have most recently been explaining that is when you wake up in the morning, you have the potential of being in that highest frequency because while you sleep, the momentum of your point of attraction ceases. So when you first wake up, before you begin thinking thoughts of what went wrong yesterday or what you have to do today, you have the greatest potential of aligning with that pure, positive energy. So if you can focus there and allow a little momentum to get going, what happens is you tune into that Source energy consciousness, who is always aware of everything you are doing. But it isn't something that just happens. You have to focus yourself into that alignment. That is the best way of describing it. In other words, Source is there for everyone at all times. We are always there. And so when you are aware of the presence of Source, and when you're not offering a vibration that prevents you from your alignment with Source, then you have those wonderful moments. And you can do that all the time. And people refer to those who are doing that as masters. But all of you can do that. It is the mastery of focus. That's what it is. Early morning momentum. Wayne Dyer. I wake up every morning at around 3 o'clock. Many years ago, there was a great poet named Rumi who said, "The morning breeze has secrets to tell you. Do not go back to sleep. Do not go back to sleep. Do not go back to sleep." I've written many of the books that I've written when I've been awakened like that. What is it? What is it that awakens me? It's like I can almost tell you the exact time. In a film I did years ago called The Shift, they show a clock, and it is 3:13 a.m., almost to the second, every single time. Is that the angels? Is that divine source? Is that someone saying, this is your purpose? This is the time when there are no distractions? The thing we most want to say is that Source is available to you at all times, but what is important about your story is that for some reason, that is the time that you decide to listen. But there's nobody else around to distract me. And that's the important conversation to have. So what is it about that time? What is it that's happening that makes you more resonant, more receptive? It is that the momentum of your thought has stopped while you are sleeping, so there's no contradictory vibration going on within you. So now you are more likely to hear. Esther has been saying to herself when she awakens in those early morning hours, "Am I awake? Because if I am awake, I'm going to get up." In other words, she can more easily pick up on the thoughts we're offering because of the absence of resistance at that time. That's what you're talking about. Yes, but I find for me the most creative moments are during that middle of the night time. Well, think about why that is. When you think a thought for as little as 17 seconds, law of attraction will bring another thought like it to it, so momentum ensues. What do you mean? Law of attraction will bring another thought like it to it? What is law of attraction? Let's say that you wake up in the morning and rather than finding that clear space that is potentially there for you, instead you begin thinking about the trouble that you had yesterday at work. You remember the dilemma you were in the middle of. You think about the discomfort. You think about the discord. And as you focus for as little as 17 seconds upon that, more thoughts like those come into your mind. If you continue to think those thoughts for another 17 seconds, there will be more momentum still. another 17 seconds, more momentum still, until you cross something as brief as the 68-second threshold. In just that short amount of time, you have missed your window of resonance with Source. That happened to Esther recently, and so we said to her, "Well, you can always begin again tomorrow with more positive thoughts." And Esther said, "I refuse to accept that I have to wait all the way until tomorrow to get back on my high-flying disc. I know I can do it by focusing." And we agree that with some deliberate focus, Esther could return to a stream of more positive thoughts. But it is much easier to do it before negative momentum begins than after negative momentum has begun. So we like to talk about the law of attraction because it is the vibrational engine that manages everything. And we can't talk about law of attraction without talking about momentum, because there is a momentum in thought. And if you think a thought long enough, it becomes a strong habit of thought. That is what a belief is. A belief is just a thought you continue to think. Sometimes you continue to perpetuate beliefs that do not serve you, but when you first awaken, those beliefs are inactive enough that you could find a fresh one that comes from Source that is about who you really are and what you really know. Wayne, is the reverse of that if you awaken and you have a very positive thought, such as, "I'm going to heal myself of this"? Well, that is a wonderful thing once you get that momentum going. But would the 17-second rule apply to that as well? The 17-second rule applies to everything. It is very helpful for you to acknowledge that law of attraction, whether you are aware of it or not, is responding to the vibration that you are offering right now, and therefore momentum is occurring. So if we were standing in your physical shoes and the thought felt good, we would focus on it. We would think more about it. We would talk about it. We would write it down. We would discuss it with others. We would deliberately encourage that momentum. But if it is an uneasy thought that feels uncomfortable, then we would do our best to generalize it. The more specific you are in a thought, the faster the momentum. The more general you are in a thought, the slower the momentum. Esther remembers being in San Francisco and driving to the top of one of those hills. She couldn't believe that people were actually driving up and down them. So imagine perching your car at the top of one of those hills and taking it out of gear and taking the parking brake off. And now, just for fun, to see what will happen, you nudge your car a little bit from behind. Well, you know what will happen. With only a slight nudge, your car will careen down the hill. But if you step out in front of it right away and let it bump up against you, you can easily stop that unwanted momentum. You would not want to be at the base of that hill trying to stop the momentum. And so your thoughts are the same way. Every thought is vibration, and law of attraction is responding to every thought, and therefore the thought is going to increase. The only question is this thought one that you want to increase? Because it is going to increase. Law of attraction insists that it will. What about affirmations? Wayne, I talk a lot about the I am discourses. I am is another name for Source. If you're feeling weak, but you have a thought of saying, "I am strong," or "I am well," or "I am healed," or "I am wealthy," or "I am positive," or "I am loving," I mean, that's one of the lines from the book of Joel. Let the weak man say, "I am strong." It makes sense, however. There is an effort factor that can have a backfiring effect, because every subject is really two subjects, wanted and absence of wanted. So if you are feeling not strong, but you say, "I am strong," which end of the stick are you actually activating? When you feel the need to apply strong effort, you are usually trying to overcome what you have actually got going on vibrationally. And so instead of it working out the way you want it to, it works in reverse. In other words, you are trying to make those affirmations and actions compensate for vibration that is going in opposition to what you really want. And your words cannot buck that current. That's why you feel the need to try harder. Affirmations are wonderful, but we would make sure that we are feeling really good when we affirm, because the universe does not hear what you say. The universe hears what you mean. Wayne, it also responds to how you feel, doesn't it? That's right. That's how you know what you mean. So if you're feeling weak, but you are proclaiming that you're strong, the louder you shout it, the more the universe is hearing you demanding something that you do not feel or believe, which is the reason that you're trying so hard. It is as if you go down to the edge of the river with your canoe, and you put it in the water, and you point it upstream, and then you paddle very hard because you believe that in order to get something done, there should be some struggle involved. But law of attraction is providing the path of least resistance. You are source energy, and there is a trajectory of ease. It is a path of least resistance, and you can feel when you're on that trajectory, and you can feel when you get off it. The more you proclaim that you are on it, the more you're often off it and trying to get on it. Sometimes it is better just to take a nap. Choices before coming forth. Wayne. All right, I've got a very important question. Not that these haven't been. I have 8 children. Playfully. You have our condolences. Well, before I had any children, I had 8 theories about how to raise children. And now I have 8 children and no theories about how to raise children. I have a daughter. Her name is Serena. And when she was about 9 or 10 years old, she used to always complain to me about my fathering, about my parenting, you know, giving me lots of advice about how I do this wrong and that wrong. And I had been listening to some of the things that Abraham was saying, and then one day I just got fed up with her complaining, and I said to her, "You know, if you don't like the kind of father that I am, the kind of parent that I am, then you shouldn't be blaming me. You should really be taking a look at yourself and asking yourself why in the world you would pick me to be your father." And she put her hands on her hips, rolled her eyes at me, you know, that 10-year-old kind of look, and she said, "You're telling me that I actually picked you to be my father and picked mom to be my mother?" I said, "Exactly right. And when you're making important decisions like that, you should really be very careful about them." Abraham, "Also, you are right now evoking the kind of parent I am being. Your expectation is so powerful, I cannot override it. We seem to have rendezvoused on a vibrational spot that makes each of us want to blame the other for what's going on here." Wayne, "So her final response to me, which was the best response I think I've ever heard from one of my kids, was, 'Well, then, I must have been in a hurry.' And so my question to you, Abraham, is, do we have access to knowing or choosing who our parents are going to be before we show up in this world of form?" Yes. How does that work? Well, there is a powerful trajectory. It is a powerful but general plan. You knew that you were coming forth, and you knew that the variety would be perfect. You knew that the variety would inspire you to your personal new preferences. Wayne, but when you say you knew, in what way? I mean, there's no brain to work with. There's no body to work with. You're in this formless, playfully. What does brain have to do with consciousness and knowing? Wayne, you're the one who has to answer that. The brain is the focusing mechanism that you are utilizing here. But there is consciousness that is outside of what you call the human focus of the brain. That's this vibrational thing we continually talk about. We talk about vibration. We talk about energy. We talk about thought. And eventually, once enough momentum has occurred, you will feel emotion. We want to acknowledge that the emotions that you feel are manifestations, and there's a significant amount of momentum that has occurred before your emotions show you how well aligned or not you are with that broader perspective. So, before you came into this physical body, you were consciousness, and you were eager about projecting some of that consciousness into a physical body, because you knew that in this physical body, with all of the other wonderful and diverse physical beings that would share this time-space reality with you, that you would be inspired to new ideas, and that really turned you on, because you are an eternal being. And you knew that being born into a physical body surrounded by the variety and contrast of planet Earth, that you would be stimulated to new ideas, and that without new ideas, that eternity would cease. But of course, you knew that eternity will not cease. You knew that this time-space reality would continue to inspire the new ideas. So, you had a general sense of your well-being, and you understood your absolute worthiness. One of the great benefits for Esther and for all of you, because of Jerry making his transition in non-physical, is that Esther now has a keen sense of his continuing existence and of his awareness and interest in the things that she is now doing. She can feel his consciousness, and she can feel her alignment with him. She can feel when she is off on a path that he is not a vibrational match to. And Jerry, you see, is an example of the non-physical consciousness that has always been there. Humans often believe that the continuum of life is about one generation being born, and then another, but that is not the true continuum of life. The true continuum of life is that you come forth into a physical body, you explore contrast and variety, and you find things that interest you and delight you, that amaze you, and that encourage you, and you continually give birth to new desires. And those things that interest you, those desires that you give birth to, do not stop when you make your transition back into non-physical. Instead, you join that cadre of non-physical consciousness who is keenly interested in the things that you were interested in before you experienced what humans call death. But now, from your non-physical perspective, you are interested from a place of no resistance. You no longer contradict your desires with doubt and unworthiness. Now you are pure, positive energy, you see. The thrill bumps that you experience are evidence of our enthusiasm for what you are experiencing in that moment. You think those thrill bumps belong only to you, but they are actually you resonating with the way we feel. So never confuse the fact that we are non-physically focused and therefore formless with being mindless or emotionless or disinterested. And that is a good stopping place for this week's program. Coming up in the next few weeks, we will cover things like interacting with those past. He forgave his father. Contrast and your point of attraction. There's so much violence. Can a handful impact millions? Programming before sleep. Parent-child dynamics. He can see clearly now. Doomed to make choices? Being on your path. Is overcoming obstacles necessary? Inundated with bad news. And more. Well, as always, I ask if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions to please contact the station and ask them to email me or call me and let me know so I can address them on air. And unless they are just not forwarding things to me, I haven't been receiving anything, so I'm going to assume we're providing the kinds of things you want to hear. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher Program.